Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Carrie at K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, if hunting can't protect wildlife, what can? Now, if that sounds counterintuitive, think about this. Why would the sport of taking deer and birds and fish for food and trophies be the key to their survival? It's because the fees and taxes that hunters pay and fishermen pay are the greatest source of money for managing wildlife. Here in Minnesota, we add lottery money to the mix for environmental protection, but even in the upper Midwest, the money is on the decline. More on how this works in a minute. I'd like to hear from you on how hunting is viewed in your family. Do you have kids who simply aren't as interested in your family tradition of hunting and fishing? What if instead of relying on hunting and fishing licenses, the state imposed a wildlife fee on everyone? What would you think of that idea? So talk to me about the tradition of hunting and fishing in your family, but also consider this idea of levying a different fee that would go directly to wildlife as I said, as hunting declines. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. I'm on Twitter. It's at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Our guest this hour, Meadow Caulfield Hansen, is a faculty member at Itasca Community College. And a conservationist and a hunter. And she joins us from Grand Rapids. And Meadow, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Hi, Carrie. Thank you for having me.
Paul Thielander is with us. He's chief of the wildlife section of the Fish and Wildlife Division. He's with me today in the studio. And Paul, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Good morning. Thank you for the invitation.
I thought I would take a couple calls here because we've got people who are very eager to talk about this. So let me go to Victoria in Minneapolis. Hi, Victoria. Thanks so much for calling so quickly. And what are you thinking about this?
Yes. Hi, Carrie. I'm not a hunter. I do have some hunters in the family. Like it was mentioned in the top, I would be willing to pay a wildlife fee or a license, quote unquote. I'd also like the option to buy a license to redeem the life of, let's say, a wolf hunt is reestablished. Mm. I'd like to buy a license to save a wolf's life or a bear's life or something like that. I think that the DNR should open this up a little bit and recognize that more money is brought into the state for wildlife preservation and enjoyment than hunting.
Okay.
And I think that we need to support that.
Good to have the call. And I think we'll discuss more of what you've said in just a bit. Paul, I was surprised to see how reliant wildlife protection is on hunting licenses and fees. Up until recently, I gather that hasn't been a problem.
That's correct. And this goes back to way back in time. Back in the 1800s, there was advanced market hunting going on. A lot of the common wildlife species that people hunted were getting low in numbers, and that prompted hunters to get together and talk about ways to generate money for regulated hunting seasons and habitat projects and acquisition, all those things, way back in those early years. So that came about, and then wildlife are held in public trust. We have what's called the North American Model of Wildlife Conservation, mm-hmm. where wildlife populations are held in public trust and managed by government agencies for the benefit of the public.
But Meadow, if you look all across the country, and as I said in the introduction here, this is even happening in a state like Wisconsin and Minnesota, we're seeing declining money for wildlife protection. So what's going on with this tradition of hunting and fishing in American families?
Well, we are seeing a decline, especially in regards to hunting. Not so much as up here in the upper Midwest as we do see elsewhere, but certainly there's a decline. The majority of the hunters right now are baby boomers, so they kind of were born in that 1948 to 1968 time period. And as they move through, there's not really a huge wave of younger participants coming in behind them to replace them as they drop off. I mean, it's there. It's just not as significant as we would need to sustain a current funding.
I bet we're going to hear from some listeners here who can't get their kids or their grandkids interested in hunting and fishing. Let me go to Bruce in Plymouth. Is that what's going on in your family, Bruce?
Yeah, yes, it is, man.
What happened?
Well, my son and my daughter they just didn't like the idea, I guess, or brainwashed or whatever. I can't say brainwashed, but, they...
wait, are they're morally opposed to hunting, Bruce? Is that it?
Not my son is. My daughter, she's, back and forth on it. She's not discouraging her son, my grandson, but she's not encouraging it either. Let's put it that way.
All right. Let me go to Todd in Prior Lake. Todd, what does this sound like? We heard from Bruce that some of this is just about the whole idea of hunting. Are people still hunting in your family?
A lot of them are not. A lot of them are morally opposed to it. And even my nieces and nephews, they like the fact of like going out snowmobiling, but I brought them on a couple trips over to Wisconsin in the UP of Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And even going to the different places and what used to be really popular, the kids aren't just there. I mean, there's not a lot of young kids doing it anymore. But one of my best friends is a coach for a trap team, which is like target shooting. They don't shoot animals. They just shoot targets. That's coming on around again. I mean, that's flipping back. Oh, that's getting a lot more popular in the school.
Okay. So a couple things for me to talk with our guests about here, Todd. Meadow, what about this idea of moral opposition to the idea of hunting? Is that playing a role, do you think, in its decline?
You know, I think that there's been a long-term perception in the media, and there's a lot of bias there. I guess I see a lot of negativity towards hunting and hunting sports. If you look back in Hollywood, even most of the villains have either taxidermy or they hunt. Same with Disney.
I never realized that. What a good point.
Long-term bias, yes, and those creators, whether or not they're aware of it or not, are perpetuating a negativity. In addition to other things, and certainly there's a moral bias against hunting, but the argument, if educated, is that hunting is one of the highest moral levels of meat eating. If you do consume meat or animal products or use leather, hunting is one of those things that is the most ethical and of highest moral level as compared to, say, going through industrial livestock. There's nothing wrong with our agricultural system in that regard, but mm-hmm. if you're concerned about morals and ethics, taking responsibility for your own food and how it is harvested and how it lives its life is a much higher road to take. And that's one of the things that we do have going for us in these younger generations that are coming into hunting is this locavore or ethical taking of food and being responsible and connected to your food rather than just going and buying it at a grocery store.
Paul, I want to share a couple of numbers here from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. You probably know these. That they report that in the 1960s and 70s, 10% of Americans 16 and older hunted. And I would guess that number was higher, of course, up here in the upper Midwest. Today, only 5% of Americans hunt. The number is declining fast. And I wonder if you think that this is something that Todd and Bruce brought up. It's just kids don't want to be outdoors overall the way they used to be.
Well, I think kids have a lot of distractions these days. There's a lot of other things that they can do now they didn't have at their disposal in the earlier days, things like Xboxes and cell phones and laptop computers, those kinds of things that can just eat up lots of time, Facebook,
How do you compete with that then?
Well, that's a challenge. It's I think you try to get kids introduced. We have like youth hunting opportunities and youth programs geared at getting kids outdoors. I think those are ways to get them started. And if they have a successful experience, enjoyable, I think you can get them hooked that way. But it's a challenge.
What's your own experience? So given the work you do, this was a natural interest of yours. But how young were you when you were out in the woods and on the lakes fishing?
Started angling at probably age 5.
Wow.
In hunting at about age 11 or 12.
Because this was a tradition in your family?
Strong family tradition. My father and uncles, yeah, strong family tradition, both hunting and angling.
So, Meadow, what you said earlier about the baby boomers, that was the main cohort that was interested in hunting. So now maybe we've got the kids of the baby boomers who are now maybe parenting young kids. And you can see now where the tradition is waning through that.
Yeah, and you know, it wasn't that baby boomers were the largest cohort of hunters. I mean, certainly, that's the largest one that we have right now. There's been a big cultural shift in North America as we've continued to progress. You know, there's less focus on consumptive use of the outdoors, so foraging and hunting is not as important for people's food. And so that's kind of declined, and now it's become more along the lines of less of a focus on food acquisition, more as leisure. But certainly, you know, children that their parents or grandparents hunt are much more likely to take on hunting.
Makes sense.
A lot of it has to do with the social support. You can bring children in as much as you want, but if their families are not in support of their activities, you know, children don't have transportation, they don't have financial means to buy equipment, much less licenses,
mm-hmm.
and they need opportunities. And so it's kind of, to some extent, dependent upon parental participation and support.
Just curious, Meadow, how old were you when you were out in the woods for the first time with your parents hunting?
I've been out as long as probably my first year of life, I would assume, was the first time my dad took us.
Wow.
Along, you know, I remember my earliest memories are being wrapped in the back of a Jeep and a wool blanket and going along deer hunting with my mom and dad. And I've been doing it, you know, like Paul, I've been shooting since I was five and fishing since about that age too. And I'm fortunate, you know, I'm kind of come from a different background. My father actually moved to America so that he could enjoy our natural resources and the freedom to hunt and fish without having to be wealthy or privileged, which is part of that North American model of wildlife conservation, is access without prestige, land ownership, or wealth.
Yeah.
And so to me, you know, it's a particularly important thing because of my familial background, but certainly it's very important that there's a social support in order to foster hunting and fishing. If there isn't support from the parents, the children aren't going to be there. And so we'll get into it later, I'm sure, but that's the importance of involving adults in hunter recruitment and retention, not just children.
Yeah, we'll talk about that. Julie tweeted me a picture. She says, our family hunts and fishes. It's a healthy lifestyle. However, we also enjoy observing nature more. Here's a photo of bear tracks taken while snowshoeing this morning. Wow, impressive, Julie. Jen says, my spouse would love to deer hunt, but the time frame is difficult with kids and hockey. Overscheduled kids here, Paul.
Mm-hmm.
Jen says, I would love to have the meat in the freezer and avoid processed from the store. And then another listener here says, I'm a 40-something Minneapolis resident, 20-plus year vegetarian, who now deer hunts with my family in northern Minnesota. Nothing more free-range and non-factory farmed than Minnesota deer. Is that opportunity right there reaching out? So how do you see that?
Well, I think part of that is, you know, just asking people, do you want to be active in obtaining your own food, high-quality food? And I think you get people interested that way. Okay, how do I do that? And then we talk about hunting programs.
This is the locavore thing that Meadow was bringing up.
So, yeah.
So maybe some different marketing to different audiences here to bring more people in on this?
I think it is. And it's really part of our R3 program, which is recruitment, retention, and reactivation,
uh-huh.
that we've got actively underway. We've had the first Becoming an Outdoors Woman program in the state of Minnesota, or in Minnesota, the first in the nation of its kind.
Uh-huh.
And
this
women
is,
have,
this is targeted towards women.
Yes.
What age?
Women in the outdoors. It was primarily adult women, but young women as well, young females. So there's programs to try to get those folks interested. It has become a growing percentage of our hunting population.
Why don't we try to get some of those young women on the phone lines? So I'd really like to hear from you. If you're a young woman, who are you targeting? 40 under?
18 to 44.
Okay, 18 to 44. So if you're a young woman, 18 to 44 years old, I want to hear from you about whether hunting was a tradition in your family and whether you'd be interested in reactivating, as Paul says, right? You'd get interested in the sport. You're doing it now. Are you teaching it to your kids? Looking for women 18 to 44. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter here, at Carry NPR to Mark in Golden Valley. Mark, you are not 18 to 44 as a woman, but we want to hear what you have to say. Hi.
Hi. And I think a lot of this comes down to cost and competition. Cost in that we don't live in as much of a rural population anymore, so a lot of people do not have land access.
Yeah.
And you have to pay for land access. I grew up in Rochester. We used to ride our bicycles at the edge of town with our guns strapped to our 10 speeds, and now to hunt in those same lands, it'll cost me $120. When I go out and hunt in North Dakota and western Minnesota, I never see any father-son combinations anymore. It is primarily people that have money. All throughout the country, if you want to hunt deer, you have to have a land lease that you pay for 10 years, and those leases could be $1,800 a year. So
okay.
We really cost a lot of people out of this.
Mark, let me interrupt if I may, because this is such a good point. I don't want to lose it. Paul Meadow brought this up, too, with her father coming here to have access to land. Is this a problem? Is this a deal?
Well, I think he makes a good point because things have changed with the amount of access people have to private land. But what I wanted to mention here is that we have a wealth of public lands in Minnesota that are open to hunting. So we've got several million acres of state land in the state of Minnesota. As part of that, we have 1.4 million acres of wildlife management areas all open to public hunting. So those lands are out there. People just need to access them. The other thing I think he mentioned that I'd like to comment on is that we have more people in the urban areas now than we used to. There used to be more in outstate
right.
Minnesota. So that
yeah.
that's changed. I think with that change, it's people have become less participative, too, in hunting in England,
although
both.
I will say in an area like this, right, natural spaces are so close to our city centers. But I get that for many other areas of the country.
Yeah, and I think that is a key to having areas of public land close to metro areas.
Right.
Urban areas where people can get to quickly. He mentioned that on the phone. I think that's an excellent point. They need things close by.
Ryan says on Twitter, our family hunts for good organic meat, but in addition to youth hunting programs, we also need to focus on recruiting new adult hunters. They're better able to make decisions, buy licenses, and have the time to devote to hunting. What do you think of that idea, Meadow?
That's certainly something that we've been focusing on in general as R3 folks in the last couple of years. You know, certainly R3 efforts have been around for a long time, and they've tended to focus on youth. And so there's kind of a shift with the research that's been done by several different entities towards adult recruitment and retention.
Got it.
And, you know, that's something with these women's programs. And then just adult recruitment in general is growing in importance because of those reasons, like I stated earlier. You know, adults are really the ones who have the means to take it on. And if you spend money and energy, some of these recruitment efforts can be quite costly and energetically expensive. You know, you spend a lot of time on it. And if you don't... If you're recruiting children whose parents aren't supportive and they don't have the wherewithal themselves to take you out and continue those experiences and continue to nurture those skills, it's almost pointless other than the fact that you may have given the child a positive experience. And one other note is that, you know, women are the fastest growing demographic in hunting, and women tend to have a very high influence on their children, and there's a lot of single mothers now, much more than it used to be. And
mm-hmm.
so... you know, it's equally important to recruit from both genders, but women, to some extent, have become more of an emphasis because of that kind of level of influence.
I have some of those elusive 18 to 44-year-old women on the line. So let me go to Joanna in Lino Lakes. Joanna, I'm so glad you called. Tell me about your experience with hunting and fishing.
So I grew up with a dad that just hunted and fished. So he had three girls. So all three of us now fish and hunt. And my husband, on the other hand, did not grow up with a dad that hunted or fished. So it's not a huge push for him, but it just was such a great thing growing up that I just have make sure we're fishing in Canada. We're fishing on their lake. We're going out hunting. They've taken their gun safety classes, and it's just an important tradition to carry on.
So how young were you, Joanna, when you were taken out fishing or hunting for the first time?
Fishing was really young. I would say hunting, I mean, the first two deer I shot, I was in 10th grade, so
okay.
15.
Yeah. And your boys, I mean, clearly you've influenced their love for this, but you don't have to force them to get out in the woods with you on a day of hunting.
No, and they love it. It's so different than, I think, the Xbox and their phones and all the things I think that really pull at kids these days, that it's just being out there in the wilderness and having, you know, good time with grandpa or with me, or just, I just don't think kids get those types of experiences that much anymore in today's society.
Really glad you heard the show, Joanna. Thanks for the call. To Sue in South St. Paul. Hi, Sue. What's your story on this?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, I've been hunting for about 25 years. I started hunting with my husband, and I thought, well, I'll give it a try. We hunted on public land for 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the third year, I took my first buck. Very exciting, by the way. And I was sort of confronted in a very threatening way by another hunter. And so after that whole thing got done, the season was over, I said, I'm not hunting unless we have our own land. And I agree with one of the previous callers, access is such an issue. And so now we have our own land, but I just think it would be really interesting if there was a mentorship program that allowed somebody to accompany women on public land for their first hunt.
Okay, so that's a great idea. That confrontation with the other hunter, you felt threatened in some ways. Nothing came of it, but it was a experience for you.
Oh, yes. I was approaching the deer, and I had seen this hunter before, and he approached me. He said, you know, I've been tracking that deer all day. I'm thinking, well,
okay.
You know, you didn't shoot it. And he just stood there until my husband came up after, you know, behind me. And it was just, I'm thinking, we're both armed. This is sort of crazy.
Yeah, I can see why that was frightening. What a great idea on the mentorship program. Paul, how would that work?
Well, we do actually have a program just like she described there, where we have a select number of adults will take hunting with mentors each year on public land to give them that experience.
Okay.
And kind of learn how to do it.
I mean, is this a, I don't have my own guns or gear,
correct,
or how do I get into the program kind of thing?
Exactly.
Okay.
Someone that's never done it before, doesn't have any of the equipment, the firearms or the hunting gear.
You don't
gear.
Have to have that.
No.
Huh.
We'll work. And then there's a series of classes that happen through the course of the summer ahead of the hunting season that teach people about, you know, habits of animals, how to read sign, how to field dress a deer, you know, how to place a stand, what to look for sign for hunting, those kind of things.
You know what I was wondering about, Meadow, was this idea of nostalgia that, you know, in some ways this is associated with the older generation.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're in your teens and 20s, that doesn't seem very cool. It's something that the grandma and grandpa used to do. Why should I be interested in that? Do you think that the sport suffers a bit from that perception?
You know, I think it used to more than it does now. It's almost trending that people are looking to seek to reconnect with the natural world.
Yeah.
And one of the, obviously, the most intimate and close ways to get back to nature is to hunt and fish and to forage. Certainly, that's a pretty strong connection. And that's, so I think that to some extent, my experience is, people are starting to look back and find ways to return to nature, return to the land, and whether that's everything from growing your own garden to canning to going out and actually hunting or fishing and bringing back meat to share with your family. I do see that as a glimmer of hope, is that, you know, it's not necessarily, maybe in the 90s, you know, I remember when I was younger that it certainly wasn't cool. And I have similar experiences to that previous caller, being intimidated by men in the field.
Jeez.
Or at least them attempting to, and being harassed by anti-hunters. But, you know, I think that there's definitely a glimmer of hope that people are somewhat nostalgic for returning to nature and reconnecting, especially those folks who are urbanized and very disconnected from the natural world.
Meadow Caulfield Hansen, one of our guests, by the way, if you've just tuned in for this conversation about how wildlife protection and hunting and fishing are intricately aligned, and as fewer people hunt and fish, even, yes, up here in the upper Midwest, less money goes into sources for wildlife protection. And we're talking about why that is, why fewer people are hunting, but then some of the solutions for amping up some of that money for wildlife protection. She's a faculty member at Itasca Community College, also a hunter and a conservationist. And Paul Thielander is in the studio with me from the DNR, where he's the wildlife section chief of the DNR. Paul, I don't want to forget to mention this. I had a note to myself here on the Pittman-Robertson Act, which, as I understand this, it requires that states use the money from an excise tax on guns and ammunition to go into wildlife protection. Is that, do I have that right?
That is correct. Act was passed back in 1937. It was part of an effort there, again, to direct more money at conservation. So it's called the Federal Aid in Wildlife Restoration Act. It was authored by Pittman and Robertson, those two legislators.
We're selling a lot of guns in this country. Why?
Correct. So it's a 11% excise tax on guns, ammunition, bows, arrows, those kinds of things. And that all goes to the Fish and Wildlife Service, and they apportion it out to the various states.
And yet that's still not enough money to support these
Correct.
Practices. Okay. To support the wildlife protection.
Yeah, it is a big influx of money to our state for conservation purposes. I think in recent years we've had funding in the range of $12 to $20 million per year from the Pitts and Robertson Fund. So it is an important program, but it really helps our Game and Fish Fund.
But not enough. To Christy and Nicolette. Hey, Christy, hi. Thanks so much for waiting. You're a hunter.
Hey, I am.
Tell me.
I'm in my early 40s. My grandfather hunted deer. My dad hunted deer. And I've fished my whole life, and I continue that. Probably not anywhere near as much as I'd like to.
Mm-hmm. So this was something that was a tradition within the family.
Yeah, it was. I have, I'm one of four children, and I'm the only one that hunts. So I think it's kind of strange how everybody else seems to be so disconnected.
Yeah, you know, Christy,
being outdoors.
How old are you, if I may ask?
43.
So when you invite friends, I don't know, work colleagues to go out on a day of fishing or hunting, is that something that most people are eager to do?
You know, I think that it is. I think a lot of people, particularly those that don't have a whole lot of experience, they want to be asked. Because I think that a lot of times they really don't know what to do. So I think it's really good. And what I found is that asking somebody out once is great to kind of expose them. But, you know, you have to keep going. You know, you have to take them out a half dozen times, eight times, so that they get a feel for what they're doing and they're comfortable to do it on their own.
Good point. Meadow, that's an excellent point, as in, you know, come along with me on one day is probably not going to inspire a dedicated love for the sport. How do we get at that?
Well, that, you know, it's certainly what we would call the one and done experience. And it makes people feel good and makes people feel like they're moving the needle that are hoping to recruit, you know, new participants. But in reality, we really do need that repetitive nature, a mentor, someone who takes you under their wing and is willing to share their knowledge and take time out of their schedule. You know, we're busier than ever now, and that time afield for people, whether it's fishing or hunting, is precious.
Yeah, we heard from the mother who said we can't fit it in with kids' hockey, right?
Exactly.
So
that time becomes even more precious to people who make it an active part of their life. And so, you know, they really have to make a conscious decision that they are going to sacrifice some of their personal time to, you know, educate and mentor somebody else. And that's for some folks, it's a lot to ask for. And oftentimes when you try to recruit mentors and people to participate in educational opportunities, it's, well, you know, I've got, that weekend's mine. That's the only weekend I've got for myself. And, so it's a tough balance. But certainly, you know, that previous caller is correct. You really do need a repetitive experience. You need somebody to take you out multiple times to build that foundation and teach you and give you those experiences. Or, you know, these are three efforts that have multiple course and sequence opportunities where you're learning and you're developing skills over a period of time so that theoretically by the end you're a lot better off in trying to figure these things out on your own.
I did not think that we were going to hear from so many young women who were into this, Paul. I'm surprised. But here's Maggie in Prairie Farm. So Maggie, tell me a bit about yourself.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
So my husband and I hunted for the first time last fall. We have a small farm, and we grow most of our own food, and we want to continue that trend as much as we can. So I was a strict vegetarian for many years, but now that we live out here and have this farm, we decided that if we want to eat meat, we should produce it or hunt it. So we had a really nice experience. We actually did a mentorship program. So someone who had been hunting for many years in a hunting family came out with us and helped us in our hunt. And we had a really great experience.
Jeez. And Maggie, how old are you?
I'm 29.
Okay. Paul, I have to say, who knew when we opened the phone lines we'd get so many young women? So there is hope for...
That's a bright spot.
It is. Okay. What about this idea of levying a tax on, I don't know, the wildlife? This is something I do. I like to go bird watching when I'm traveling or, you know, go spotting wildlife. What about levying a tax on the gear to make up for these losses?
Yeah, that's an interesting idea. That was actually proposed in Congress back in the 90s. I'm going to say early 90s. It was under a proposed program called Teaming with Wildlife, where there would have been a tax on things like birdseed and binoculars to try to bring more people into wildlife conservation.
What do you think of that?
Well, I think it's a great idea. I think it's time to bring more folks in. There's a lot of ecosystem services provided by public lands, and by putting more grass in the landscape, like in Southwest Minnesota, we're acquiring new WMAs, providing things like clean water. So I think there's room for all to contribute to that
of an effort. Are you aware of any state that that does that or has kind of a model program on this?
Well, most of the efforts that I'm familiar with have been done kind of on a nationwide effort because all the states have a similar dilemma here.
Okay.
So I guess I'm not aware of what – I'm sure there's some variation of what different states have. I just can't speak to
Meadow,
what those specifics might be.
What do you think of the idea of that as a tax on, you know, the wildlife observation gear or – an extra tax on going into, parks and spaces to see wildlife?
Well, I think that that's important, and it's something that, you know, has been missed over the last century. Is, you know, hunters and fishermen, since the 1950s at least, the fishermen have been paying for a lot of the resources that people benefit from
right.
and enjoy. And that'd be land and, like Paul mentioned, clean water. And, you know, traditionally it's been pay to play for hunters and fishermen or women or anglers. And so, you know, it's logical that those people would have to contribute as well. But there has been, like Paul mentioned, pushback, which, if you could only imagine the revenue that could be generated, say, if we had 11% excise tax on binoculars and birdseed. even, you know, trail passes, wildlife management areas in Minnesota that were typically purchased and maintained by these funds that Paul's mentioning regarding the excise tax and then license sales in the state. You know, that makes perfect sense. You know, again, it's been on the burden of the hunters and anglers to pay for those things. And, you know, certainly they're the foundation of conservation efforts, the reason why a lot of these resources are here for us to enjoy today. And it makes sense that that model will continue to evolve, though, and include other users, those folks that benefit from them. So I'm in favor of it for sure.
Yeah.
There's downfalls, but I'm in favor of it in general.
Your point on the binoculars I bought, they weren't cheap, and adding 11%, I get that. But here's some context from a U.S. Fish and Wildlife report that I found interesting. 86 million people observed, photographed, and fed wildlife in 2016. They spent almost $76 million in doing that. That would seem, Paul, like a rich source of, maybe more money for this.
I think it would
preserving
be.
Preserving the spaces that we're going to.
Yeah, and that's
do this.
The fastest growing, I think, segment of outdoor activity is that
is
wildlife
it?
Viewing and watching. It's been ramping up for some years now. And so I think there's an opportunity there. We just have to talk to people and convince them that it's a good idea.
Here's Joe in Minneapolis. Joe, I'm tight on time, but I wanted to hear from you. What's your take on this?
I'm with a group that we formed about 3 years ago. It's called Twin Cities Walleyes Unlimited.
Uh-huh.
It's a nonprofit. Our goal is to connect with children, women, men who are interested in learning to fish or want to get reconnected with fishing or who want a guidance to get retained in fishing and enjoying the outdoors in Minnesota. We have a website, tcwalleyes.com. We meet monthly September through May, the first Thursday.
Okay.
We have a Twitter account. And we're in this whole hog. I mean, we have big name speakers, Gary Roach, Al Lindner.
But Joe, less about that, but more about, I mean, is this a situation where you have to have your own gear to get involved with Walleyes Unlimited, or are you doing this mentoring thing like we were talking about?
You do not have to have your own gear. We do the mentoring. We kind of mentor. We kind of have a classroom thing, I'll call it, which is the monthly meetings. And then we have club outings in the summertime. Mm-hmm. And we actually did some stuff last winter with the Wounded Warrior Project and the Vets And we brought the gear. We teach the kids how to fish.
Cool.
We do it in a boat. We work with the Hennepin County Park System and some of the suburbs and their park and rec programs. You know, I'm not a fisherman, but I grew up being a farm kid in Iowa, but I got up here and you got to learn to fish. It's great. And even if you don't catch fish, it's still a great day on the water.
Joe, if it would ever stop snowing, we could, you know, the rest of us could get out on the lake. But I appreciate your call. And again, the group is called Twin Cities Walleye. I have a listener on Twitter who says, my husband hunts, wants to take our sons out, but we can't get into a range to practice. Waiting list 2 years long. Paul, have you heard about that?
Well, I know there are, you know, there's a lot of demand for shooting range opportunities. There are many shooting ranges in Minnesota, but I can't speak to the specific problem there. But it sounds like they can't find something within reasonable distance to get to.
One last note here from Nate, who says the Minnesota High School Clay Target League has 300 high schools, 12,000 kids involved throughout the state. And I guess archery in the school's program is successful as well. Okay.
Yeah, those seem like really logical links to people taking the next step to get into hunting.
Paul, really great to have you on the show. Thank you for being in studio. Meadow, very nice to talk to you. Good luck with the hunting and the fishing throughout
the rest
of the year. Thank you. Hey, thanks for all the calls from all the younger women who are out there hunting. Great to have your view on this. If you missed the show, it's on the podcast. Search NPR News with Carrie Miller, wherever you get your podcasts. And thanks.